So I was trying to think today about what I might talk about this evening. And my thoughts kept coming back to wanting, feeling kind of a need perhaps to say something that addressed the anxiety and the concern people have around potential war in Iraq. And it's loomed so big in many people's awareness and thoughts. And didn't quite know what to do. I mean, I've talked about such subjects in the past, and I thought of talking about refuge, the idea of the going for refuge, taking refuge, and in times of difficulty. One of the resources that Buddhists have is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And then I thought about the topic theme of protection, which I brought up yesterday in the morning in the talk. And you find in Indian Buddhism, classic Buddhism, a big emphasis on protection. And I think it's a continuation of probably what was a very popular concern at the time of the Buddha. People sought for protection. There was a lot of dangers in life. Certainly dangers of illness, sickness, old age, dangers of livelihood and losing your livelihood, dangers of robbers, dangers of armies and war that came wandering through India at the time. And so people looked for protection. And there were certainly lots of people offering protection, protective devices, as there still is in this today. People who offered amulets, and you could wear amulets around your neck or a little different, or you learn mantras, or you would learn, you do particular rituals that would protect you. And and the Buddha came along, and his emphasis for protection was not to do things that would protect you externally from the world around you so much, but his emphasis was to protect your importance of protecting yourself internally. And in fact, the idea of protection in Buddhism is that you're protecting yourself from yourself. Because the source of your own, the word is very powerful in Pali, your own torment, the word klesa. One of the fundamental things that classical Buddhism is trying to address is something called the kleshas, which are translated into English sometimes as the torments. And that way in which we torment ourselves. So the inner critic is one way that people torment themselves. But there's many ways in which we torment ourselves. And the Buddha offered his particular insights for a way of helping people deal with these inner torments, the way in which we torment ourselves. And so the protection the Buddha offered is that protection which protects us from the inside. This last week, I've talked to two friends who traveled in opposite directions. One went to New York and to Boston, and he commented on how much anxiety people on the East Coast have compared to here on the West Coast. And I've heard other people say the same thing. The idea of terrorism, the idea of war in Iraq and its consequences for America, and loom much larger for people on the East Coast for a number of reasons you can imagine. And then my other friend spent last six months living in Thailand. And she said what a relief it was to live in Thai culture, in Thailand. She lived in northern Thailand, a place where there's, I think, virtually no foreigners living there. She was supposed to teach English at a university. And she had 100 students in this rural university to learn English. She was supposed to teach, I think she was supposed to teach business English. The problem was nobody spoke any English. And she was a little bit perplexed about how to begin teaching people English. She didn't have any place to begin, and especially a room full of 100 people. But she had a lovely time there, and she talked about how wonderful it was to be in a Buddhist culture. She spent a lot of time, or days off, going to Buddhist temples and visiting Buddhist teachers, and talked about how wonderful it was to be in a society, at least parts that she saw, the corners she saw, the monasteries and that seemed not to have the same consumer frenzy that she felt when she came back here. And she's a therapist, and she commented repeatedly about how delighted she was in a country that had, the whole country has only, apparently she claimed, only 400 psychotherapists, or psychiatrists, or something like that. But there are 40,000 monks. And she liked that ratio quite a bit. And here in America, she said, you know, there's probably 40,000 psychotherapists and maybe 4 monks, Buddhist monks. And but the thing that struck me most was her story of a meeting one teacher that she said changed her life. And she became a kind of very devoted disciple, a student of this teacher, and we'll go back and be with him some more. And she said that there were 2 things that struck her about this man. Or maybe 3 things. One, she said, was that he was a field of loving kindness. That you just kind of, you get close to him and you feel all this loving kindness kind of radiating from him, this love, this kindness. And the other thing she felt from him was, she said that he seemed to be empty. And Buddhists talk about someone as being empty. It's one of the highest compliments you can give to a Buddhist. And though in popular English, maybe you know, that person's empty doesn't work so well. But the teacher I had, the teacher of my teacher in Burma, Ajahn Mahasi Sayadaw, he was described to me as being someone for whom it was like a house in which all the lights were on, all the windows were open, all the doors were open, and there was no one home. And all the faculties were very alive and vibrant, and the person was very receptive and aware of the world around them and connected and everything. But there was no ego, there was no self-definition, there was no self-defense and protection, trying to be something for anybody. And that the kind of many things that we tend to fill ourselves with, torment ourselves with, was missing in this person. So my friend described her teacher in Thailand as being similar, kind of being empty. She said of him also that he, as far as she could tell, she had never met a person whom she felt his work had been done. And that is an expression in classic Buddhism of someone who's attained full enlightenment. Their work has been done. Because once you're fully enlightened, there's no more work, no more spiritual work to be done. And she spent a lot of time with him, and that was her impression. You know, she was very constant. It seemed like his work has been done. She was very inspired by him. And he also talked about to her about how it had not been easy for him to practice. His practice had been difficult, but he'd done it. He hung in there. And she thought he was relatively young. He was 49 years old. He had been a student of Ajahn Chah, from that lineage, those of you who know him. And the advice he kept giving her, and this is what the part that really resonated with me today, that made me kind of happy hearing his advice to her, was his advice to her was, repeatedly was, plunge into nirvana. As if, you know, it's right here to plunge into. And, and plunge into nirvana, into nibbana in Pali. And when I heard that, I was reminded about peace. And many of us are concerned with, international peace. But is there a kind of peace which is available for us to plunge into right here as we sit here? Is there a kind of peace that's available in our own hearts and our psyches that's not so far away? And something that's a refuge, something that's a protection, and something that's available to us that we can go to. And does it have value for us to find this kind of peace? Is there some kind of peace that's available to you even in times of strife, even in times of difficulty and conflict? I get a lot of lessons around this at home with my 5-year-old who seems to be constantly exploring limits. And there are some days where it's very clear that I can be in a very conflictive situation at home. and I can be completely at peace. And there are other times where the whole situation is conflictive, and I'm being tormented. Not by him, of course. Unless I get deluded. But the torments always come from ourselves. So the idea of peace, finding peace, and is it value for people to be at peace with themselves, to find peace? And I find that sometimes in myself, and certainly many people, will sometimes feel that being at peace for themselves, or plunging into peace, resting in peace, peaceful state, seems not justified. That it feels wrong to do it when there's strife and suffering and tension in the world around them, whether it's the family or community or in the wider world. And I know there are few people who grew up in family situations where the only way they showed love was by worrying. So it's very important to show you worry, because then you show you really cared. And if you didn't worry, then, you know, people thought something was wrong with you. You didn't really care. But are there ways in which we feel that in order to be responsible for our world and around us, to feel connected to doing something, that we have to get hooked in and lose touch with the peace that's here always? And that's really one of the great challenges, I think, in a spiritual life, is a challenge between that force that wants, or that voice, or that impulse that wants to pull us away into the world and be hooked and attached and reactive to it, even for seemingly good motives, and that force, that potential within us, to stay balanced, equanimous, at peace with ourselves. In the Buddha said that he was teaching a path to where we protect ourselves. Part of the message of the Buddha is that if you can protect yourself from yourself, you'll never leave that place of peace. Even though you might go into conflictive situations and try to deal with them and respond to them and act in them, but there's no need to leave that place of peace. There's a remarkable discourse in these books of the Buddha. And it has to do with a king. One of the kings at the time of the Buddha, he comes to visit the Buddha. And he says to the Buddha, "Just now, venerable sir, I have been engaged in those affairs of kingship typical of great kings, great warrior kings, typical of those who are intoxicated with the intoxication of kingdom, who are obsessed by greed for sensual displeasures, who have attained stable control in their country, and who rule having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth." Could you imagine him going to the Buddha admitting this is who he is? I was engaged in typical activity of a king like myself. I was intoxicated by my power and obsessed by greed. So the Buddha says to him, "What do you think, great king? Here a person would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable. And having approached, the person would tell you, 'For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a great mountain high as the clouds coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king.' Then a second person would come to you from the west and say the same thing. And another person from the north, another person from the south, saying that this huge mountain, as high as the clouds, was barreling across the country, crushing everything in its wake, all coming to converging right here where you are. Do whatever you think should be done, great king," they say, each of them say. Then the Buddha goes on to say, so imagine this situation. Then the Buddha says, "If, great king, Such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done? So the king said, "If, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of life, what else should be done but to live by the Dharma, to live virtuously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, aging and death are rolling in on you. When aging and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done?" And the king says, As aging and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dharma, live virtuously, and do wholesome and meritorious deeds? The king goes on, there are, venerable sir, elephant battles fought by head-anointed warrior kings who are intoxicated with the intoxication of power, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained stable control in their country, and who rule having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth. But there is no place for those elephant battles, no scope for them when aging and death are rolling in. So it's kind of a powerful image, I think, this image of these great mountains rolling in to crush us all. And the guy realizing, well, there's nothing else you can do at that point. What would you do? Would you kind of just lament or be afraid? It's pointless to be afraid if it's happening anyway. And he's arguing, when such great danger is coming, the best thing you can do is to live virtually, to live the Dharma, and which means various things. Live virtually and do wholesome deeds certainly is a way of creating conditions for a better rebirth, which is a classic Buddhist understanding of what happens after you die, after the mountains crush you, the mountains of old age and death. But also to live by the Dharma. And to live by the Dharma is to plunge into the peace, is to find that place of in your mind, in your heart, in your psyche, where you could be deeply at peace and liberated from all the fears and the hates and desires which torment your psyche. And to be engaged in that, to find that place, to plunge into that possibility. And there are some people for whom they don't plunge into that possibility of peace until they come across some major catastrophe in their lives. When sickness and old age really hit someone, there are sometimes when that, only then do they really let go in a very deep way. And they find that there's a kind of stillness, a timeless presence that's always here. But we're all usually so preoccupied and caught up in our thoughts and our activities and all the things we should do, that the timeless present, which is here, you know, is not something that we taste, tune into, listen to, feel. And perhaps we spend a day walking down the beach on the coast here, and maybe by the end of the day we lay down and look at the sunset, and then we kind of feel, kind of in that restful place, we feel this timeless presence which is always here. But we have to wait for special moments for that. To live by the Dharma, to find that place of rest, is one of the central tasks, I think, of Buddhist practice. So there's another time that this king came to visit the Buddha. And he said to the Buddha, "While I was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in my mind thus. Who now treat themselves as deer? Who cherishes themselves? And who treats themselves as a foe?" Then, venerable sir, it occurred to me, those who engage in misconduct of body, speech, and mind treat themselves as a foe. Even though they may say, "We regard ourselves as dear," still they treat themselves as a foe. For what reason? Because of their own accord, they act toward themselves in the same way that an enemy might act towards an enemy. Therefore, they treat themselves as an enemy. But those who engage in good conduct of body, speech, and mind treat themselves as dear. Even though they may say, we regard ourselves as a foe, still they treat themselves as a dear. For what reason? Because of their own accord, they act towards themselves in the same way that a cherished person, a dear person, might act towards those they cherish. Therefore, they treat themselves as dear. And then another time he came to the Buddha and he said, I was alone and I had the following thought. Who now protects themselves and who leaves themselves unprotected? So this is the issue of protection. Then it occurred to me, Venerable Sir, those who engage in misconduct of body, speech, and mind leave themselves unprotected. Even though a company of elephant troops may protect them, or a company of cavalry, or a company of chariot troops, or a company of infantry, still they leave themselves unprotected. For what reason? Because that protection is external, not internal. Therefore, they leave themselves unprotected. But those who engage in good conduct of body, speech, and mind protect themselves. Even though no company of elephant troops protects them, nor a company of cavalry, nor a company of charioteers, nor a company of infantry, still they protect themselves. For what reason? Because that protection is internal, not external. Therefore, they protect themselves. It's considered to be an appropriate thing in the teachings of the Buddha to cherish oneself. Certainly selfishness is considered a problem, self-obsession. But to have some basic deep appreciation and cherishing of oneself is a beautiful thing. And to protect oneself is considered a healthy thing to do. The suggestion here is we protect ourselves. The reliable protection is that way we learn to protect ourselves from the inside. And this is one of the reasons why awareness practice is so phenomenally important in Buddhism, to pay attention. Because by paying attention, that's how we can learn to look in and see where the choices are, where the activity, the impulses, the motivations are, the mental activities are that cause that internal dangers to ourselves, the internal torments of ourselves. As we know, someone can do something terrible to you, and in doing something terrible to you, you have various ways of choosing how to respond if you're quite aware and balanced and present for that. And there are ways of responding where we add torments to ourselves, where we to be filled with resentment or anger, even justified anger. There's a kind of violence to ourselves. But someone who stays present and balanced and knows peace and knows how not to be stuck in their anger, be stuck in their resentment, is learn now how not to add torments on top of a difficult situation. So it kind of, in the same line of what's said here, it's said in Buddhism that when you get angry with an enemy, you're doing your enemy a favor. Because you're doing to yourself what your enemy actually couldn't do for yourself. So to be at peace, to find peace, to reflect on where is peace found, and to look at the voices inside of you that argues against peace, argues why it isn't justified in any situation, why it shouldn't be, why the voices inside of you that argue or tell you or insist to you that other modes of being are better ways of being. That being caught up in hate or anger or fear are better modes of being. So as this country faces war in both directions, people in the East Coast feel the threat of mostly of things happening in Iraq, and people in California now are beginning to get some little itchy feeling about missiles from Korea that is supposed to be able to reach California. There's all kinds of things, hopefully we do, respond and act. But one of the contributions of Dharma practice is no matter how we respond and act, no matter what we do, that one of our tasks as Dharma students is to be very, very conscientious about how we protect ourselves, how we don't add, protect ourselves from ourselves. So we don't meet hate with hate. We don't meet anger with anger. Because it isn't so much because that creates bad conditions in the world, which it often does, but we're actually going very much against the grain of what is the greatest safety, the greatest happiness and peace, the greatest welfare that's possible for any individual person. I was so inspired by my friend coming back and talking about her Thai teacher. Individuals who found how to be at peace with themselves in the world are like this bright light in the world. And I think it's a great gift we give to the world around us. If we can respond to the world and act in the world, engage in it, you know, in a responsible way, in all different ways, livelihood-wise, politically, all kinds of ways, in ways that we're being careful with our hearts, careful with our psyche, with our inner life, so that we are protecting ourselves from our own torments. And by protecting ourselves from our own torments, protecting our own quality of mind, our quality of our own peace, we actually also then protect others. It's a tremendous gift we give to others if they can encounter us when we're at peace with ourselves. So to plunge into Nibbana, to plunge into the timeless that's here. Is it here for you? What's here for you now? What is it in you that is coloring your present moment experience? What happens if there's nothing inside of you which colors or influences or judges, or criticizes, or holds on to your present moment experience? Is there some plunging, leaping, leap of faith into some timeless dimension which is here now? So those are my comments for the evening. And now it's your turn if you have any comments or questions or reflections. Yes, please.
I just came back from 3 weeks in India. And before I left, of course, everybody was afraid for me as far as traveling. You know, are you going now? This is crazy. And it was the same sort of projected fear that I got 10 years ago because there was turmoil there with the Muslims fighting the Hindus, and I was flying right in the midst of that. Of course, I wasn't touched by any of them. And when I came back from this wonderful odyssey, things were just about the same. But I was in a complete news vacuum there. I had shut down. There was no TV. We lived on a 40-acre campus overlooking the Ganges for 9 of the days of the 3 weeks that I was there. And I came back, and it was almost like things just didn't change. It was the same chatter, the same people worrying about the world events. And so for me, what was really obvious is that the form of self-protection is just to take a complete news fast. I mean, we don't need to be inundated constantly. I go to a health club and they have a big TV in the men's locker room, and I have to bypass it quickly because everyone gravitates around this horrid news, and then everybody has to repeat what they're saying, of course. So a news fast was fine. I felt no danger being there. Everybody said that, oh, didn't you get smears and this and that. So, to me, that would be a form of self-protection, is to just turn off the news.
Sure. I think it can be a wise thing. In the context of this talk, I think that would be considered an external protection, because it's doing something about the external world. If one is open and attentive, although, you know, one wouldn't intentionally shut anything out at all. You don't have to go intentionally look for trouble either. But the internal doesn't require that we shut off anything. The internal protection works even if we're watching television.
So the internal protection for me on this trip, and as well as being home, was to continue the same level of practice, which was meditation and yoga in this particular case. And it took 23 hours to get home. It was a week ago, Friday. And, you know, I greeted my family and dispensed some gifts and thank them for giving me the space to take this 3 weeks, which I try to do once a year. And I was back at yoga class that same Friday after this 23-hour flight, and just continued my same, you know, inner program of trying to keep the peace from the inside.
Beautiful.
So it's, yeah, you know, one sort of complements the other. Mm-hmm. And even coming here, I mean, I was still having a little bit of jet lag, you know, it comes in waves. And it was, you know, important for me to make an appearance here to continue the practice. Keep consistent.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you said was you were gone for 3 weeks and things didn't seem to have changed, at least in this, in terms of the, I guess, the war in Iraq and all these things. In 3 weeks, you didn't miss anything in those 3 weeks in some ways. And it immediately reminded me that, or struck me that, you know, you could be gone for 3 years or 30 years or 300 years and you'd come back and there's a chance you come back and, oh, they're still talking about the same kind of thing. It would be different countries and different players and different, you know, particular issues. But if you go back in time, human history, you know, this is like, oh, those humans are doing it again. Can you believe it? And so with that kind of perspective, it isn't to minimize how important it is and how tragic it is. But in that, you know, this kind of thing that rolls through human history constantly over and over again, the expectation that it should be different might be part of the part, as adds to the suffering. Yes.
I wonder what the Buddha would do about something like this. And part of what feels a little iffy when I hear you speak about the inner peace is just that I feel like we live in a different time now, because I am present with what's happening on the other side of the world, which we may always have been on some level, but not in the way that we are now. And I feel like there's two camps now. There's the people that are completely sucked into that reality, and there's the people that are just turning it off. And I feel myself somehow being part of both worlds. And so if I look at what I see the monks doing in the old traditional ways, is that they really have permission to turn the world off.
Right.
And they're sitting in their cave, and they're not just meditating for their own enlightenment, they're doing it for mine and for everybody else's. And it's their job to the whole. So I see that as a very, very sacred work. And then there's the other side of the people that are feeding those monks. And I wonder today if more and more if we're not really doing both, and how to do both. How to be involved fully and full-heartedly in an effort to be at peace, but at peace with the willingness to live truly in my torment every day.
Does, yeah, that make any sense? So you started off by asking, what would the Buddha do? I don't know what the Buddha would do, but the example of Buddha's life is someone who did not live in a cave, but someone who has actually wandered around India and was in, you know, in the presence of kings and beggars and the whole realms of everyone there. He was very much engaged in the world there, and was engaged in conversation and debates, and went to visit the kings at times to talk about war. And it seems like someone was very much engaged and right in the middle of it. And do we live in a time now where there's some kind of split between, only doing inner work and shutting off the outer world is no longer sustainable? I would kind of imagine, or at least hope, that that split never has been sustainable. You know, our life isn't, it's not like we're in a special time now, even though we know each other around the world more. I think it's unhealthy to have that split in a radical way, probably any time. More to be said about that. But one of the important teachings that I got was that a teacher of mine said that the contribution Mahatma Gandhi made to Buddhism was that Buddhism teaches that it's very important to sit, to meditate. And Mahatma Gandhi said his contribution to Buddhism was, it depends, it's important where you sit. So, and that means many things, but, if you meditate every day, it's very important. Maybe you might as well meditate maybe on the, down in the dockyards where they're loading up the tanks. And blocking the tanks from going off to war. You know, where you sit is important. What communities you sit in. The San Francisco Zen Center, was built somewhat intentionally. But they bought a building somewhat intentionally in a dangerous, poor part of the town because they felt it was very important where you sat and to sit in the midst of that kind of environment rather than off in the suburbs somewhere where it was wealthy and well-to-do people. Where you sit is very important. So that's one way of healing that divide, I think of. But then sitting is both literal and metaphoric. Yeah, and I in no way imply that, want to imply that that focusing on your inner safety, your inner peace, is meant as an alternative to being engaged in the world. But I think that the strength of Buddhism. The strong point of Buddhism is not that, doesn't have all the answers for how we should live our life. But the strength of what Buddhism has to offer is it offers practices, it offers teachings, it offers a kind of a understanding of the human mind that helps us in that particular area to protect ourselves from ourselves, to find that inner peace here. And it's really one of the great systems for doing that in the world. And that's a strong point. And it doesn't mean that's the only thing we should be doing. It's like, we have 1 minute. Yes?
Some of the kinds of states of mind that arise in you are pretty clearly things that ought to diminish with increasing equanimity and inner peace. You shouldn't feel anger and agitation and hatred. But how about just a sense of sadness? Is that something that should somehow not be part of one's consciousness if one attains this sort of inner kind of protection?
How, upon what authority, what basis do I answer your question? Certainly, in the sutras, the classic answer to that question is that certain kinds of sorrow, lamentation, and grief are dispelled through Dharma practice. That's the whole one of the points of Dharma practice, is to finish that. Is there sadness? When the Buddha's main disciple, Shariputra, died, the Buddha was supposed to have said, it's as if, the sunlight or the sun has been darkened. Imagine that to feel a sense of loss, to feel sadness, to feel. I don't think if someone's being killed in front of you, I don't think you're supposed to be going whistling down the streets, whistling Dixie or something, or feeling happy. I think to feel the seriousness of that, the sadness of it, the intensity of that. I think it's part of my take. This is not talking personally. Is the expected part of life, but then, there's there's also, so, you know, Charlie Brown talks a lot about good grief. You know, and then there's the opposite of that. There's bad grief. And so good grief is that which moves through us. So that was a kind of, you know, a rough answer, but I think there is a place, there's an appropriate form of sadness or feeling that things are off. Okay, so thank you very much.